Welcome to the Daily Friend Show, offering insightful and thought-provoking news commentary and analysis from a classically liberal centrist perspective. The show is brought to you by the Institute of Race Relations. Tune in at 4:30 every Monday to Thursday for engaging discussions from our team of analysts and researchers that you won't find anywhere else.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and it is the last episode for this week that we are doing because, of course, tomorrow is Heritage Day, and I hope that many, many of you are able to take Friday off as well so you can have a nice long weekend. And we are going to be discussing some fun stories today. So I'm joined, of course, by Mr. Terence Corrigan. Terence, how are you this fine afternoon?
No, I'm good, Nick, and yourself?
Yeah, I'm not too bad. It's quite pleasant today. And Mr. Herman Pretorius. Herman, how are you?
I am very, very well. Thank you very much, Nick.
Excellent. Well, let's get right stuck into it. And this is, of course, one of those stories that one hopes to never have to read, but because it's a sort of a dark portent of what may yet be. And this is the South African National Defence Force, SANDF, Chief Solly Sonke has issued a statement criticising senior SANDF members for allegedly being invited to a ANC meeting to discuss internal party politics. This is a statement. It says, "It has come to my attention that there is planning for a meeting where several senior SANDF members have been or will be invited to discuss matters currently affecting the ruling party. It must be categorically stated in no uncertain terms that no SANDF member is authorized to attend such meetings to discuss petty political matters. The SANDF remains an organization that's above party politics, serving the sovereign security interests of the Republic as mandated by the Constitution. We distance ourselves from any calls to discuss politics, and we'd like to sternly warn any members of the army against discussing party politics in the name of the military." So I think that it's very good that a statement like this is issued. It's very important considering that, when the army starts to get involved in politics, that's when you really begin to have a total breakdown of democratic and liberal institutions in society. But I guess the larger question here, and I'm going to go to you, Terence, about this, is what is the relationship exactly between the SANDF and the ANC government? Is it something that we should be concerned about? And do you think that there's any scope for the SANDF to become involved in South African politics? Do you think it's likely, rather, anytime soon?
I think that this is one area where we are quite fortunate. We do not have a politically engaged army in the way that say Zimbabwe has, or many other countries across the developing world. What tends to happen is that a country reaches a point of crisis and there's an intervention, because the army is one of the few institutions that has some sort of institutional coherence to the implicit promises that it'll steer the country through into better times. Now, frequently, this is not the case. Now, South Africa, as I say, has been fortunate not to have experienced this. The army has generally kept out of politics, and I think that there's one word that attaches to this, and this is professionalism. Now, I was actually thinking about this when the story broke, and I remember that Nelson Mandela's autobiography talks about his inauguration, and it was attended by these bigwigs from the old SADF. And he said, there was a certain irony here, that people who would have arrested him or fought with him a couple of years ago were now standing there as the sort of guarantors of the order. And I think that is generally held. What does concern me, though, is that the ANC has never made any secret of its overall leanings to politicized the state. Now, in 1997, they document on this. They define transformation explicitly as the national liberation movement, taking over all levers of power, and they mention the defense force. So is there some expectation on their side that ultimately these people have to play on their playing field? I put this out as a sort of conjectural point rather than making a direct accusation. But yes, if indeed such an invitation was extended, and there was an expectation that serving military officers should attend, then that is deeply, deeply problematic and quite sinister. There are forums within the within the state where the government can, where different arms of the government are able to the sort of communication. There is a Minister of Defense to handle the political side, if you like, but soldiers have no business being involved. I think that South Africa is a sort of interesting case because we have a defense force that was built on, among other things, explicitly party political armies, Konta Wesizwe or whatever. But for the sake of the country, those sort of allegiances need to be dropped. And people enlisting in the army do so, within a very narrow and specific institutional mandate and institutional culture. Military intervention of any sort, or even the threat thereof, I think is it's certainly been a curse across Africa, and it's one that I think we'd be very wise to avoid in this country.
I think that's definitely correct, of course. But Herman, I'd like to throw the question to you as well, and to say, as Terence correctly points out, one of the ideas behind the National Democratic Revolution, which the ANC is very committed to, is that it should control all levels of power, particularly the means of violence. And in this case, of course, the army. And a cynic might say that the real reason that we haven't seen military involvement in the politics of South Africa is simply down to the fact that the ANC hasn't needed to use it because it's been able to maintain victory legitimately in elections. But that if its hold over the country was ever properly threatened, then the army might start to become involved. Is that too cynical, or do you think that's realistic?
Keep it light, Nick. No, I think that's it might be cynical, but it is of course of concern. I think it's a very valid point to make that the ANC has not yet been faced with its existential defeat as a governing party. So it might feel that in 2024 or 2029, when elections actually will be highly contested in the sense that there's a real risk of the ANC losing power, then I do think it wouldn't be beyond the pale to see some of the more sinister voices within the ANC urge for, of course, the constitutional continuation of the Republic, the armed forces to step in case of a disputed election result. I think that wouldn't be too cynical. I think the ANC, if you're a cynic, the ANC really is your best friend in a sense that gives you a lot of reason to be cynical. But one thing that I do think that counts in our favor as liberal democracy is, as ever, the incompetence of a bunch of socialists. In Zimbabwe, they really had the army played a massive role in internal politics of ZANU-PF, factions using military might against each other. But the fact of the matter is that the Zimbabwean army had more might to use, whereas much of the South African armed forces and army are just an absolute state of disrepair and just malaise and just incompetence. So I think that the ANC might be tempted to rely on the army to, in a future disputed constitutional situation, shore up its mandate and its position in power. But I think they will then find themselves rather with their pants down because they spent 30 years essentially just hollowing out the army. So I think the philosophy and the politics here quite concerning and threatening. But I think if you actually drill down to the real life consequences of the South African army and its involvement or not in politics. I think that you will find South Africa in a different position to Zimbabwe, where our army might not be such a big threat to our liberal democracy, simply because it isn't much of a threat to anything.
I must say, I'm not quite as sure about that. I mean, despite the many, many problems with the SANDF, it is still a relatively well-equipped force, and one that I think people perhaps would underestimate, because when you're struggling against civilians, it really doesn't take that effective of an organization to gain the upper hand if you're a military. But I think this is a very good sign. Herman, go ahead.
On that point, I do think it might be useful just to consider that not only do I mean that the army is in a bad state in its equipment and in its funding and in its training, but in its chain of command, you might end up in a situation where the top leadership of the army are highly politicized. But I very much doubt that loyalty to your political cause will be of sufficient conviction down the lines to really cause the military as a singular unit to become commandable. I think you are in a situation where the loyalty of soldiers to the institution, because of the weakened chain of command and the weakened loyalty to institution, I think that when I think about the South African army not being too much of a force politically, were we ever to reach such a point, I think my thinking is guided by, of course, many things that go wrong in the army, but fundamentally underscored by the problem that you sit in a country where loyalty towards the army isn't, I think, something that is so deeply entrenched in society more broadly, but I think even within the chain of command itself. So I think I'm approaching it from that perspective as well. I might be completely wrong, but I hope I'm not.
And of course, that does remain to be seen. But I must say, I am very pleased, though, that the chief of the SANDF has come out with this statement. I mean, this is the first I saw of the story. I don't know what pressure was put on him or if he did it entirely of his own volition, but I think that it's a good sign that he's issued a strong statement like this. It speaks well of the health of our democracy in a certain way, that the army it probably could have gotten away with just sort of burying the story and denying it, but coming out like this and aggressively saying something is a good thing. But I do think that the way that this sort of works is the army might be a bit of a dormant institution, in the sense that as long as it's out of politics, it's not really it's not a real threat. But if there ever comes a point where it does flex its muscles, it might suddenly realize that it holds a lot more cards than it ever thought that it did. And let's hope that day never comes. Anyway, from that light topic, let's move on to the American Senate election. So, of course, the American election is taking up a lot of people's who are interested in politics. It takes up a lot of their news reading and interest. But we often forget that, of course, the American political system is quite complicated. And every 2 years, they vote for the lower house of their parliament, the House of Representatives. And every 2 years, they also vote for 1/3 of the Senate, which represents the various states in the United States. And unlike our upper house of our parliament, the National Council of Provinces, the American Senate is actually a very important, influential institution that has a lot of constitutional powers. And whereas currently polling suggests that Joe Biden is a favorite in the American presidential election, although who knows if that's actually true, the polling shows that while the Democrats are slightly favored to take the Senate from the Republicans, it's a very, very close thing. And I think it would be very risky to take any bets on who exactly is going to maintain control of the Senate. Herman, what's the state of play in the U.S. Senate and why is it important?
Well, Nick, I think from where I'm sitting, at least, I've become convinced that the real election to watch in America isn't actually the presidential election, but the senatorial ones. The reason being that you have I'm starting to think it is more likely than not that Joe Biden will win the presidency, for the mere reason that even if you build into into the current polling, you know, a 2 or 3% misrepresentation or underrepresentation of Donald Trump's support, he still falls short, especially in states like Pennsylvania, which, according to my calculations, Trump desperately needs to win the White House. So if you look at the Senate and at the impact the Senate elections and the Senate as a constitutional and congressional body might have going forward, I'm starting to anticipate a situation where Joe Biden is president. But then it becomes a question of which Joe Biden will be president. Will it be the Joe Biden who has been in politics for 42 years as, you know, not a hard left politician, someone that never really bought into significant amounts of identity politics or, you know, the modern era of wokeness, but is actually has a track record of a solid center left social Democrat. But because I think if the Senate goes Republican, but Biden wins the White House, then you will see a Biden presidency much in the nature of what Biden has been as a politician for four decades, this center-left politician, sensible social Democrat with a pragmatic approach to defense and fiscal prudence. But then if Biden wins the presidency, but the Democrats win the Senate, then I think you have the way paved for an extremely radical Biden presidency, where the platform that Biden has adopted will become more powerful because all three levers of constitutional government in the USA will then be in control of the Democratic Party. And the Democratic Party really is in a state where the radical tail wags the dog, where your more radical extremists like AOC and Ilhan Omar and, you know, Bernie Sanders even being the nutcases who control the policy direction of the party. So looking at the Senate, it is a very important body, and it is a very important body if we were in a situation where Ruth Bader Ginsburg hadn't just died, because the Senate has now suddenly become even more interesting. Firstly, it could be the guiding force in the presidency of Joe Biden, who I think will probably win the election. But then secondly, with this vacancy suddenly appearing on the Supreme Court, you now have this opportunity for the Senate to become, as it were, the middle point, the focal point of this election cycle, which will have fascinating implications to see whether, you know, will someone like the incumbent senator of Iowa, Joni Ernst, be boosted in a very close race in a state that Trump is expected to win in November? Will Senator Tillis in North Carolina get the same, you know, consolidatory effect that he has been struggling to achieve by getting the Republicans in a Republican state like North Carolina on board? So generally speaking, I think it's a fascinating indicator of what might happen presidentially after the election. But also now is the moment to see, will this sudden unexpected vacancy on the Supreme Court, will it galvanize support in either directions or in both directions? And what will it actually do to strengthen the hand of longtime Senator Darth Vader Mitch McConnell or his opposite Chuck Schumer? And just as a perhaps the last explanatory note is that in the Senate, you have, of course, two caucuses. You have the Democrats who have two independents caucusing with them, and then you have the Republicans. And the party that is in the majority in the 100-seat chamber forms the majority party, of course, and they determine the times, the time schedule and the roster and the legislative agenda of the Senate. And Mitch McConnell really has been a master political strategist when it comes to using Senate procedure, using the legislative agenda to push forward his own Republican approach, especially when it comes to federal judiciary positions. So all in all, the Senate has gone from very interesting and very vital to absolutely brilliantly interesting and absolutely core vital to what's going to happen over the next 40 days as we approach the election.
It's also worth pointing out, of course, that the Democrats are expected to fairly comfortably win the House of Representatives, and that's one of the reasons why we're not particularly talking about it.
because that's pretty much a done deal. The other interesting Senate race to watch is that of Susan Collins in Maine, who has been a Republican senator, but sort of one who's not afraid to vote against her own party. And she has been there for a very long time, I think since the 90s, and it looks like she's going to lose. And she's taken the interesting decision to go against her party on replacing the Supreme Court justice. So it's a bit difficult to say where she's going to end up. But that's also another race to really watch for an interesting bellwether of how the whole thing is going. But I agree with you, Herman, that the Senate is underrated in its importance in the U.S. system, and of course that does have ripple effects to South Africa, because of course a U.S. that is completely losing its mind and pursuing radical policies is very likely to not be an ally to South Africa in our current struggles. Terence, I know you are not a fan of engaging in U.S. politics too much, because as you say, everyone seems to think that they're an expert in U.S. politics, even when they're perhaps not. But do you have anything to add to this discussion? Is there anything that struck you about the debate so far?
I don't think that I can add anything substantive to what Herman's been saying. I do think that the replacement of a Supreme Court justice could be very significant, and it's actually something that has piqued my fancy or my interest in U-rate. Maybe I can throw a question to you guys. Do you think that it's possible that they could have someone fill that seat by the time the election comes, making the impact of the election rather moot?
I think, well, for my part, I think that's pretty likely. I think that as Herman talked about, Mitch McConnell, the Republican Senate leader, is very eager to get another Supreme Court justice in their camp, and I reckon he's going to fast-track the thing. There may be some hesitation because he might be scared that the race will negatively affect some of his weaker, more vulnerable caucus members, but he probably also thinks that it's worth the sacrifice, even if they lose the Senate. That's my thoughts anyway, Herman.
Yeah, there's no constitutional time frame for how long confirmation should take, but it's you arrive at a point where it's you have to look at the political realities. If the Republicans were to use a so-called lame duck session after November 3rd to confirm a justice after just having lost the majority in the Senate and possibly the White House, and then I think you set them up for a very, very brutal 2 years, because as Nick pointed out earlier, that every 2 years, a third of the Senate is up for re-election. And of course, the House of Representatives is up for re-election every 2 years, the whole of it. So if they were to, they have a majority now, and they have the White House now, the Republicans. So if they were to use that majority and the White House to confirm it now, to confirm filling the vacancy now, I think it would be the best case scenario for them, because alternatively, they use a lame duck session if they lose the White House and the Senate, and then set themselves up for 2 years of absolute torture, having just received rejection from the electorate, to then bulldoze an appointment or a confirmation to the Supreme Court through. So just from a tactical point of view, Mitch McConnell has been obsessed by the judicial makeup of the federal judicial system in America for as long as he has been in politics. He was a first-term senator, if I remember correctly, when Robert Bork was nominated to the Supreme Court. And Bork's failed confirmation was really the first time that a confirmation to the Supreme Court was politicized to a massive extent. And then Clarence Thomas a few years later. So very much etched into McConnell's strategic DNA is the importance of winning confirmation votes to the Supreme Court. And he and Donald Trump have been working very effectively together over the last few years to confirm a record number of nominees to the federal judiciary, shaping, as it were, the federal judiciary for the next generation, heavily slanted towards Republican jurisprudence. So for Mitch McConnell to get a third stab at a confirmation to the Supreme Court is absolute gold dust. It'll be the culmination of a 40-year attempt or a 40-year plan or strategy from his side. So if he loses that ability and he threatens what remains of the Republican caucus in the Senate by using a lame duck session or not confirming a justice at all, I think it would be a betrayal to his 40-year plan. So I think, looking at history, Sandra Day O'Connor, the first woman to sit on the Supreme Court, was confirmed in a period of, I think, 39 days or something. I'm not exactly sure what the time frame was.
I think there's also been a Supreme Court justice confirmed in about 18 days. So there is precedent for it to be done very quickly.
So it can be done very quickly. And if you eliminate all other options, either not confirming, not filling the vacancy, McConnell won't go for that, confirming or filling the vacancy, but in a lame duck session, the Republican caucus won't go for that. So by just sheer force of elimination, you reach a point where we are probably looking at a very, very quick, rapid, and rather frenetic confirmation vote. And as a Supreme Court watcher, I think someone like Amy Coney Barrett, who is at this stage a front runner for the position, would actually make an extremely effective and quite a brilliant Supreme Court justice, because I just think that they're in the originalist jurisprudence, there's a respect for the division of the state or powers in the trias politica to you know, not make law from the bench, but interpret it honestly. So I think the Republicans, on a balance of scale, have too much to lose in not pushing for a frantic, chaotic, but quick confirmation vote.
Right. And any of our listeners who are interested in this topic, can I recommend the website 538.com? They have a lot of polling analysis and statistical stuff they do there. They do lean a bit left, but I think they're pretty trustworthy if you want to get them as a way to look at polls and stuff. They do some quite interesting analysis there. Anyway, we shall continue on to our final story today very quickly. We've only got about 3 minutes left. And this is a rather strange story coming out of Camps Bay in Cape Town. A group calling themselves the Queer Radical Feminist Activist Collective has occupied a mansion in Camps Bay that was being rented out on Airbnb as part of their movement. They say that their action is, quote, part of a global movement of occupiers who do not have homes, particularly those who are close to home that are landless, cannot afford their rent or face violence in their place of residence. They seek to highlight lack of access to land, discrimination against queer people, and gender-based violence. Apparently, they raised something like, it's not clear exactly how much, but it could be in the vicinity of around 50,000 rand to rent out this property for 2 nights, and then refused to leave it once they had past their time. The company that owns the house and rents it out has said that they this action is negatively affecting not only them, who have had their business hurt significantly by COVID, but also the various staff who work around the mansion and use it as a and as their main source of income in its maintenance and upkeep, and they have asked the group to evacuate the house by Thursday next week, which they are refusing to do. So just a quick 60 seconds. Terrence, what do you make of this?
This is very 2020. Very little surprises me anymore, I must say. First of all, this collective, you can't turn it into an easy acronym. But yeah, you know, if assessments of the pricing, you know, what would it take to book this or anything to go by, and if indeed they didn't pay this, it's 50,000 rand or so, or something to make a point. Now, you know, maybe we've got the wrong end of the stick on that, but it seems. I don't know. I suppose it is postmodern. I don't think that this really sends any kind of message. It's sort of surreal. For political reasons, we hire out this very expensive property, and then we refuse to vacate. But if you're playing with a sort of cash, surely there's something more productive you could do with it.
Definitely. Herman, this group has described themselves as artivists, I believe, using art to do activism. What do you make of it? The last 20 seconds here.
No, I must say art, famously one of those powerful forces for change. I mean, nothing says, you know, stick it to the man like, I don't know, papier-mâché genitalia somewhere.
Excellent. And on that note, we'll leave you for the week. I hope everyone enjoys their long weekend. Have a great Heritage Day, and we'll catch you next week for the Daily Friend Show. Thanks everyone for listening.